You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent. I'm joined here by
Deep Tran, associate editor,
and Susie Evans.
So we just got a February issue in the office that's coming out soon. Katori Hall's Our Lady of Cabejo on the cover.
You loved that play when you saw it.
I really liked it. Yeah.
Did anyone else see it?
I didn't see it, but I got to coordinate the play script interview while she was over in Africa.
She's back
Christmas.
In Africa for, what was she doing?
She's there through early February. I think she's working on researching some new plays.
Another
I believe
one?
She was in Uganda.
Right.
I think she has family over there too. She was visiting them for the holidays.
I did think it was cool that we got, I don't even think we necessarily made a big deal out of this point that Lynn Nottage was her interviewer in our magazine, but that, you know, Lynn Nottage had that big play set in Africa as well. So they were to compare notes about, you know, being African American writers going to Africa to write a play about.
Yeah, it was cool.
About Africa. Yeah, it was fascinating.
It was an email conversation, but it was cool.
It turned out well. But no, that's our cover image and our cover story. But there was a big story, of course, about an actor. We don't profile actors as big feature subjects enough, I don't think.
We don't do it that much at all, do we?
We do, but it's not that frequently. So Molly Brennan, who's this just amazing.
Molly Brennan is
a versatile performer.
She's an amazing performer. Personal performer, a hostess. She's kind of a weird hybrid of everything. She does kind of mainstream work in Chicago. She's worked a lot at The Looking Glass, Goodman, Second City, Steppenwolf, all the main stage shows. And she's also just has a lot of indie performance styles with her 500 Clown Company, which is a lot of physical theater. She just started, I saw on Facebook, she started teaching what she calls a monster clowning class for people. She was the artistic director
that
of
sounds terrifying.
Barrel of Monkeys, which is an arts education for children in Chicago Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And right now she's playing the Red Queen in Looking Glass Alice, which is a great production. If you're in Chicago, go see it. I first heard about Molly, though, when I was at Northwestern in grad school, and I saw her in 500 Clown first, her like little clowning downtown-y theater. She did 500 Clown Macbeth, and I just remember the outdamn spot scene and her with no words, it's all like miming and clowning, like totally fascinating. And then I think that same year I was there, she did Animal Crackers at the Goodman, which is how she got her equity card.
Right.
She created her character of Madam Barker, which is now like her fixture. She like hosts. She did an original musical about it. She's very interesting, and she's someone that you don't really expect to have such a chameleon ability to go back between forms because she's got a very distinct look. She's got purple hair, she's got tattoos, and she's kind of very uncompromising in who she is. So the fact that she gets to play all these different roles is really interesting, and I think a testament to Chicago as a theater town.
Cool. I just searching for a segue there, the Barrel of Monkeys angle and Chicago. Helena Keyes was one of the founding artistic folks or directors or whatever they call it at Barrel of Monkeys as well.
Yeah.
And she has just ended her rather short tenure as the artistic director of The Hypocrites.
Yeah, she was only there for like a few years.
She was only there for 3 years. But the story is I just spoke to Sean Graney.
And you just spoke to him?
Yeah. You get these press releases that say, you know, that report rather shocking or interesting news. And they, of course, make it sound like everything's great and, you know, Sean was the founder of The Hypocrites in 1997, and then he left about 3 years ago, handed the keys to Helena Keyes, and went off. And, you know, it's funny, Chris Fire did a great feature on him, and I quoted these things back to him when he said, I think I'm a decent director, but I'm not a very good artistic director. I need someone else to take the reins who knows, who can focus on business and stuff. And so Helena Keyes was artistic director, and now he's back as artistic director. And so the question is, what happened there? Was something wrong with Helena Keyes' tenure? Was this the plan all along? Well, of course, it wasn't the plan. Sean came back and said basically he's learned a lot. He built the show All Our Tragic while he was away, and had such a great experience with like what he says community building, and rediscovering his love for doing theater. And he's coming back with crediting Helena with making a slightly dysfunctional company more functional. And also there's the artistic director position at The Hypocrites, which is a small $500,000 budget storefront theater, It's not a paid position. Mm-hmm. So Helena Keyes was not making any money, and she has a 2-year-old. And so I think they were talking last year, and basically she was sharing her frustrations with trying to balance the balancing act of doing that. And he was sort of, he just got a grant from a Chicago foundation, doesn't have kids. He said, why don't we switch? So that's why Sean Green is back at the Hypocrites. I'm going to do a Q&A, which will probably be up by the time this podcast is up.
So there wasn't like a tiff. It was just there.
There was no tiff. I mean, if anything, Sean Green is pretty honest about how there were tiffs back in his past. That basically, what he realized that being artistic director doesn't mean that he it's his football and he can do whatever he wants and he can go home. And you,
yeah. Well,
being artistic director is not autocratic. It's more like you're sort of lead. As he put it to me, you're sort of led by the people you lead. You serve them. You don't just say, it's my company, I founded it, which was always his attitude when people would say, why are you doing that? Or we can't do that show, so it's my company. He realizes being artistic director of a community, of a theater, involves a lot more, you know, what he might have said, his younger self might have said, is just, you know, politics and BS, is actually like, you know, working with people and listening to them. And
well, he's also kept up directing there since his time as founding artistic director as opposed to now artistic director. I mean, the Gilbert and Sullivan is all him up there.
Yeah.
He directed all those. He could
yeah, that was that. his thing.
All
yeah,
tragic.
And All Are Tragic is him. He hasn't disappeared from the Hypocrites.
No, God, no. And All Are Tragic was yeah, it's interesting. And he said also, he doesn't have his name on anything coming up in the near future. So I think he's wants to put his energy back into, you know, building.
Well, All Are Tragic is coming back.
It's coming back, but I mean, it's in terms of a new thing. So that was big news. The other news, Deep, you reported about Tim Dang at East-West Players in Los Angeles released a, what would you call it, 51% plan or challenge?
It's basically kind of not like a mandate, but kind of a doctrine, which says, you know, theater companies, and particularly those in Southern California, should commit in the next 5 years to making sure that 51% of their artistic personnel, of the staff at the theater, are either women or people of color or people under the age of 35. So it's not just like a racial diversity kind of mandate. But then he also said, we're not the diversity police. There's no actual repercussions for not following it. Mm-hmm. It's more about a bunch of like a guideline or something for you to kind of think about. And they have this diversity liaison called whose Leslie Ishii. She's also an actress and director, and she's worked with Oregon Shakespeare Festival on their diversity plan. Mm-hmm. And Oregon Shakespeare Festival's diversity plan is what led to things like the FAIR program and all of their fellowships that kind of promote like the widening of hiring practices to consider race, gender, all that
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
And they also have it, you know, codified in their mission statement. And so like they've been working with Center Theater Group and Longhair Playhouse and just like talking to all these big theaters and saying like, what's your plan? It's like, how can we work with you to kind of like help guide you in like creating your own kind of like diversity initiative at your theater? Because it's not every theater has like kind of a different way of doing it.
Sure, sure. The thing I wanted to ask you about, Deep, was I liked the story. I was interested in East West Players is an ethnic specific theater, and there's a few of those around the country, and I would imagine they would already meet the criterion at least in one of those in terms of they're probably well over 51% people of color who work at ESOS Players. So I'm wondering, does that mean that then they'll look at the other challenge to be 51% you know, female employees or 51% under 35?
It's or. It's not and. It's like and this and that. It's like
right.
Either
so,
women or young
so
people.
So is East West Players like not fall into it because they already are like over 51% people of color?
It was interesting because what I really admire about Tim is his ability to kind of look into his own organization, asking what are we lacking, like who are we not serving? Because he's always looking for. Okay, now we just serve Japanese American, Vietnamese American, all like the regular groups, but then he realized, oh, we don't serve the Hapa population, we don't serve
South Asian.
Yeah, Indian and Filipino, so he kind of started programming more of those works just because, I remember him telling me, just because we're an Asian American theater company doesn't mean that we're inherently diverse, or like inherently inclusive.
Right, right, right. So diversity within Asian Pacific American community is what he is looking at as well.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're also looking at codifying like their own kind of diversity initiative, or kind of making that like a mission or like a value, so that if Tim ever leaves, then it's in writing, and so so like they'll continue to continue to hire, you know, multiracial, like, because their design and artistic team isn't just Asian American artists.
No, of course not. No, it's interesting. I think one thing he talks about as sort of an objection or a common response he'll hear from organizations is they'll try to group their diversity. So say, look, we have a couple African Americans, a couple women, a couple, you know, gay folks, and that's our diversity. The rest of us are white, Caucasian, heterosexual men. And I think he's discouraging from looking at that as a way to just lump your diversity that way. But to look at it, 51% people of color, or 51% women, or 51% under 35. So I think that was what I read in there.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I found interesting is that there's no repercussion. He's not, you know, holding himself as a legally binding, you know.
And it can't
document.
Be it can't be a legally binding document. Otherwise, it's kind of illegal.
But I liked it. There would be no authority for that. But what I liked was the language that said, if after 5 years your company hasn't done it, you should probably not use the word diverse in your marketing materials or call yourself a diverse company. And also, he said maybe funders and foundations should look at your and say, So he is sort of throwing it up as a possible benchmark. So there's a stick as well as a carrot there. So said like maybe there should be consequences, not anything legally binding, but we should think about, can you really call this a diverse company if it's not?
But then
diverse by these standards.
But then there's the other end, and I know we talked about this when, I mean, TCG, which is the publisher of American Theater, went through its own diversity training and about examining, you know, similar things to what Tim talked about in the 51% plan. And then we also talked about which levels of your company or of TCG
there's
or
that too,
has the diversity. So if your whole executive leadership is, you know, heterosexual white men, and then you still have 51% women and 51% people of color and 51% under 35, but they're all at your assistant level.
Yeah, that's true.
That doesn't really drive the decision-making in your company. So I don't know if Tim talks about that in his document, but that was something that was interesting to me when we talked about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do feel like there's a lot of folks who talk about how leaders need to be groomed generationally.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And that if they are not hired at all or not brought into the organization and they learn the ropes, they're never going to be considered for those positions. So for the management position. So I do think that can be a generational project too. It would be a concern if right now all the people of color and women are in lower positions at a company and you look 20 years ahead and there's still white men at the top.
Yes.
I think probably we'll go to our critics roundtable. You were led deep. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. I'm not entirely sure who out there has not seen the play Good People, because it's been produced
many places.
Many, many places, and continues to be produced. And so for this week's critics discussion, we had Hope Bao.
I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
I know. I talked to her yesterday, and it was during a snow day, so everything that happened yesterday, I do not remember.
Where is she from, Hope Bao?
Oh, she's from Indiana, and so she saw Good People at the
Indiana
Rep.
Right.
And then there's also Carrie Langle, who saw it at the now closed Actors Theater of Phoenix. And Rob just pouted.
My hometown.
I know.
Yeah.
And finally, Bill Hirschman, who saw it at Gable Stage in South Florida. You may know Bill because he's been on this podcast multiple times
as
a critic. And so we talked about what makes a work kind of seminal, and if people are really good. So
sounds great. Enjoy. I can't wait to hear it.
So hi everyone, this is Deep again, and I'm sitting down with three critics from around the country via this wonderful technology called Skype. So can we all go around and introduce ourselves and the paper or online publication that you work for?
Sure. My name is Hope Baugh. I write theater reviews for NUVO, which is the alternative news weekly here in Indianapolis, Indiana. And also, since 2008, I've written my own theater blog called Indie Theater Habit, which I started in the hopes of encouraging people to make a habit out of going to the theater.
That's a good habit to have.
Isn't it, though?
And Carrie?
My name is Carrie Langle. I'm the performing arts reporter and theater critic for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com in Phoenix.
And Bill?
My name is Bill Hirschman. I'm the co-founder, editor, and chief critic of FloridaTheaterOnStage.com. We're a professional, vetted, edited, advertising-supported arts journalism website. And we review every professional production and write down here in the three South Florida counties.
Fantastic. And so today we are going to talk about Good People, which originally premiered at Manhattan Theater Club in 2011. I saw the original production. That was one of my first things that I saw when I moved to New York. And it's the reason we're doing this particular play, is we like to go around and, since theater is such an insular, a community sort of experience, is sometimes you do have these plays that travel all around the country and that hundreds of thousands of people have seen it, which is kind of rare in theater because it's usually restricted to one play in one particular house in one particular community. And so for Good People, it was the most produced play from 2012 to 2014, and this season there are 5 productions. And Good People is written by David Lindsay Abair, who's Brooklyn-based. And, well, I'm going to have one of you give me a summary about what this play is about. So I guess, Hope, do you want to take it away?
One of the things I love about it is that it's about so many things, but on the surface it's about a single mom, Margie, who is struggling to make ends meet to take care of herself and her 30-year-old special needs daughter. And at the opening of the play, she's fired from her cashier job at the dollar store, and so now desperate to find work again. That's what the story is, but it's all about economics and who are we responsible for. I'm assuming we're going to talk about what it's about on the other layers.
Yes, definitely. Can each of you go around and tell us about where you saw it and a sum up of what you thought about that particular production? Hope, since you just spoke, why don't you start off?
Well, and I have to be careful that I don't talk on and on because I love this. I saw this at the Indiana Repertory Theater here in Indianapolis. I saw it twice. It's still running one more weekend, so I saw it just day before yesterday for the second time. It was directed by Mark Cuddy, who is also, he directed it in Rochester, New York, I think, for the Jiva Theater. I don't know how to pronounce that because I've never been there, but
that's how you pronounce it, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. The Indiana Repertory Theater is our regional professional theater, so the actors were top quality. The music, the sound design, which was by Lindsay Jones, had all kinds of Irish, Celtic, modern and more traditional music in it. The set was like puzzle pieces. The set by Joe Wieniarski, I'm not sure how to say that name either. And Constance Macy played Margie, and she's a destination actor for me. I would go see her in anything, and in this, I think she's just exceptional. All of the other actors were new to me, but Nick Abiel plays Stevie, and is it okay to talk about spoilers? I mean, are we assuming that everyone who's listening to this podcast has seen the play or not? I mean, how careful do you want us to be?
Let's try not to spoil the play for the people who have not seen it.
Well, it's like you think you know who the good people are, and there are surprises. And there are six people in the cast, and in our production anyway, everybody was just exceptional. Just very good. I want to go see it again. Just talk to them.
Is that something you do very often, see plays multiple times?
I do. The ones I like and the ones that I feel like, oh, there's a lot. Like when I saw it the second time, there were even more resonances and even more clever, insightful things in the script and things I noticed in the story and in the acting and in the design elements. So I love that. I love a show that's really juicy or chewy or layered or whatever you want to call it. And I do go back. I think my limit is 7. I want to see...
What production was this?
It was called, Octopus, I think, by Steve Yockey.
That opens down here this weekend.
Oh, I want to come see it.
Wait, the weather's beautiful. Come down.
Arizona or Florida? Who said, who answered?
I think that's Bill. From Florida.
Yeah, I'll be, well, I can't be there this weekend, but I would be if I could.
Well, now you have somewhere to stay, Hope, if you could go down to Florida. And, Carrie, can you tell me about the production you saw in Phoenix?
Sure. Good People was produced last spring by Actors Theater of Phoenix. They were one of just a half dozen professional companies here in town. I use the past tense because they just were the latest company to fall victim to the bad economy, which is a real tragedy here because they were really the only company that was doing this type of work, very contemporary, a little bit edgy, very relevant work. They call themselves the off-Broadway of Phoenix, and they will definitely sorely be missed. They did a great job with this play with some of the best local actors in town. What I really loved about it was that it really kind of plays with the audience a little bit. It plays with your loyalties. It introduces the characters. Margie is very brassy and prickly, and she's actually a little hard to like. And you go through, as she goes through her conversations with her old boyfriend, that she's trying to basically finagle a job out of. He's a successful doctor, and they end up having a very sharp discussion about, you know, whether success in life comes through luck or it comes through the choices that you make. And, you know, David Lindsay Abaire sort of lets the audience go on a bumpy journey where you kind of go from side to side on that before you're finally invited to make your own conclusion.
And, what was your conclusion?
Well, that might end up being in the spoiler territory. Part of the conclusion, of course, is that people are complicated and that, you know, the irony of the title is none of the people really are necessarily good or bad. They're just people. They have their good points. They have their bad points. And they are all trying to negotiate existence that becomes complicated and challenging for everybody, but particularly for people who come from not a lot of money and not a lot of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Bill, do you want to talk a little bit about the theater you saw it at?
Or theaters? I saw it in New York with the original cast and was absolutely floored. And the moment it was over, I turned to my seatmate, and we immediately knew who was going to do this play in South Florida. South Florida is one of the most unsung regional theater hubs in the country. We have 50 to 60 professional theaters spread over 90 miles that we cover. But there is one in Miami called Gable Stage in a suburb of Miami. They've been around about 20 some odd years, and they have developed an outstanding reputation for taking shows that have just closed or have closed within the past year, either on Broadway or off Broadway. They like edgy work, but not avant-garde work. And they very much want thought-provoking work. And in fact, the licensing companies go out of their way to contact Gable Stage each season and say, we've got these two or three shows we want you to look at. So it's not even a matter of and to the chagrin of several other wonderful professional product companies out here who often wish they could get first crack at these things. But this has been under the artistic direction of a guy named Joseph Adler, who does superb work 95% of the time. There's a very consistent level of quality. So we almost knew when we walked out of the theater that Good People would be a show that we'd see there within a year. And sure enough, we saw it actually took all the way to July of 2013. They did a really strong, solid production. Once again, as in the case of these other two cities, we have a very large acting contingent, and Joe gets to choose usually the best people that he can. And he had a wonderful cast here. The lead actress here was a woman named Laura Turnbull. Laura is one of a handful of can do almost anything kind of parts. And if we had been casting it, you know, beforehand, she certainly is one of the names. I would point out it was a terrific production, and I was very, very pleased. But it's very interesting sometimes when you see the show in New York first. Sometimes, and I mean this, there are productions I've seen down here just recently that actually were better than the ones that I saw in New York.
Oh, those are fighting words, Bill.
It's true. No, it's absolutely true. And believe me, I've been doing this for a very long time. I come to New York a lot. It's not like I don't have something to compare it to. But there have been productions that are as good, if not better. But this one, as good as it was, I could not get Frances McDormand out of my mind. She was, for those who don't know, had the lead part in the Broadway production and or the New York production. And I don't think David Lindsay Abaire wrote it specifically for her, but you couldn't tell because she inhabited that role as well as anybody I've ever seen. And as good as Laura Turnbull was, and she was terrific, Frances McDormand was just made for that role. And part of it is because, and I think Carrie said it, Frances didn't mind being a little obnoxious, a little overbearing, not always the easiest person in the world to like. She is your heroine. You know she's the heroine, but she's got a lot of yin and yang to her. And she can not only shoot herself in the foot, she's certainly capable of not only just hurting her own cause, but being actually insensitive sometimes because she's being driven so strongly by what Hope had mentioned, which is that she has been fired from a job in the middle of a recession. She hasn't got very many job skills. We should point out that this whole play is about a blue-collar people, a blue-collar neighborhood in Boston, if I remember right, and how people have managed to get out or not get out, or choose to get out or not choose to get out, or whether they're trapped, and what defines how you get trapped in a neighborhood which seems like a dead end. And our heroine, who has just lost her job, is desperately trying to find some kind of income to support her adult disabled daughter. And she will swallow her pride to ask an old boyfriend from high school, who has in fact gotten out of this blue-collar neighborhood and become a doctor, and she's trying to hit him up for a job. And what is fascinating, probably the whole show is fascinating, but the most fascinating scene is when she tries to play various head games and guilt games on him for being able to get out, because she thinks, obviously, that luck and good breaks have as much to do with getting out as native intelligence. And he, of course, believes he earned everything that he ever has, he's earned by lifting himself by the proverbial bootstraps. And he resents any indication from her that, you know, that he happened to get some lucky breaks that other deserving people didn't. And I thought it was a brilliant play about nature versus nurture.
I also love it. Is it okay if I jump in and say
yes?
That I love that it wasn't, that was huge. That was huge. I'm intrigued by the idea of Frances. I've only seen Constance Macy in it, and she brought a delicacy, I wouldn't say likability exactly, but a fragility or something to the role of Margie that she was, that didn't seem like she was out to get Mike, the old boyfriend. He was played by Sean Patrick Riley here, and he was great too. I forgot to say that earlier. But it resonated with me because I was brought up with, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. And I think that's what Margie was brought up with too. So the whole idea of what does it mean to be nice? I mean, are there only two choices? You can be nice or you can be a selfish prick. You know, there's no, the playwright, it seems to push us to not choose between those two. And that's language from the play. That's not me. You know, that's, and when she's, when Constance, not Constance, Margie, the main character starts to speak more honestly. I mean, she's passive aggressive. Oh my goodness. She's just, yes, like one of you said earlier, she's not very likable. She's passive aggressive. She's just, but when she starts to speak honestly and more directly about her anger at this old boyfriend, he tries to shame her about it. He says, oh, hey, did you turn mean, Margie? Did you turn into one of those mouthy Southies? Did you become mean? And she backs off again because she was raised to be nice. She doesn't want to be mean. I mean, you know, there's the tension in her about what does it mean to be nice? Who, yeah. Does that make sense?
Well, there's also resentment on both sides of this equation. I hope we get to edit this because I'm going to mess this up. But there is a great line further down the play. Margie somehow manages to come to the doctor's home where he meets meets the wife that he married. And again, we're not going to give one of the spoilers away. But there's a line in there which I'm going to blow, but it had to do with they offer her wine and want to know which one she wants. And she has some wonderful rejoinder that comes back, which makes it clear, no, I come from a place where we don't know red or white wine and we don't care. And I'm going to kick myself because it's been a while since I saw the play. But I remember when that line came out, it encapsulated the entire play right there.
Yeah.
Does anyone know what the line is?
Yeah, Mike, the man says, the old boyfriend says, so what do you think of the wine? And she says, how the F would I know? Like she had no opinion even. That's how often she drinks wine. And yeah, it's much funnier in person. But
but the way she, at least both Frances McDormand and Laura Turnbull say it, it's a reproach. Like, you know darn well I don't know this, and you are intentionally putting me in a place, asking me a question. It's like, or alternatively, You seem to forget that this is not the world I come from. So,
well, anyway. or you could also look at it as her just being kind of I'm going to say grouch because I don't want to use a bad word, but you know, you don't have to be a wine expert to say yes, that's very lovely, thank you. You know, I don't know about the productions that you saw, but I didn't really get the impression of Margie as someone who was raised to be nice. I think she was raised to throw elbows. She was raised in a blue collar neighborhood where you had to stand up for yourself and you had to be tough, and that seemed to extend to some extent to the girls as well as to the boys, although certainly not to the same extent as we learn when we learn more about the backstory. You know, class is a very big part of this play, and it's something, you know, it's an East Coast thing out here in Phoenix, we don't have as much history, and therefore we don't have the same sort of class divisions. But, you know, an exploration of how class works in America is definitely part of this, you know, especially when Margie accuses her ex-boyfriend of being a lace curtain Irish.
Which really hacks him off.
I'm from California.
He wants to be a tough guy, even though he's now a successful doctor. He still wants to be authentic, and you know, that's sort of a thread running through here too, is, you know, the when you get out of the old neighborhood, what do you give up to get out?
I found it interesting that David Lindsay Abaire, who comes from a neighborhood like this, not this specific one, but a one like this, he still has a great deal of respect and compassion for both these characters, and in fact, all of these characters. He teases at them. He makes fun of them a little bit. You know, he's not ignorant of the fact that some of them are more sophisticated than others. But he clearly, particularly in the last couple of scenes, and of course the end of the big confrontation scene, shows a real sense of respect and for the humanity of all of these people. Yeah. There's a character we won't go into, but there's a character who seems to be a jerk, just a complete utter jerk. And you find out in the closing minutes of the play that, as I think Hope mentioned, everybody is a good person, everybody is not a good person, but that the concept of good people applies much more broadly than we expect, and to people we don't expect it to apply to. And there's a real gentleness and affection that Lindsay Abaire has for every single person in this play.
Yeah, I loved about the play, at least in our production, the penultimate scene, the scene before the last one, mm-hmm. ends on a funny note, and people, at least here in Indianapolis, people started getting their coats together because, oh, that's like, aha, the end. But then the lights come back up again, and there's another scene. And that, it doesn't take away from everything that happened before, but it makes it so much richer and so much more profound, and it makes us all start to think about everything. I love this. Yeah.
Carrie, you brought up a really good point, which I actually wanted to ask about, because I'm from California, and I'm of Asian descent, and so I have no idea what the term lace curtain Irish means. I assume it was an insult from the context. And so, because the play is just, it's set in Boston, and it talks about, like, this divide between the neighborhood, the high-low neighborhoods of Boston, so it's very of that place. But since it's been produced all around the country, like, do the three of you as critics find, like, the message, even though it's of one particular place, like, it's a universal message? Like, is that class divide, or is that income inequality something that, like, transcends Boston?
Yes.
I think any well-written play is going to do both. You know, the more specific it is, the more it can resonate universally because the less generic it is. So, you know, the dynamic of, underprivileged minorities, say, who maybe have a chip on their shoulder when it comes to people who do have success and get out of that neighborhood. You'll see that repeated in many subcultures, for sure. I don't think you need to know Southie accent and South Boston. The authenticity comes through the writing and the acting, where they create the world for you and they show you this is our world and invite you in. And this play does a really good job of that, particularly if it's well acted, as it certainly was here. And you learn about that culture, that the play teaches you the culture and lets you understand it. But certainly, while the culture here is specific to this time and place, you know, the dynamics are going to resonate elsewhere.
It is universal. I think anybody could watch it and have felt something at some point. You can put down for whether it's you're a white male, and you can put down for being privileged, whether you felt privileged or not, you know. Or
there's also a universality that's recognized in the sense that you have a collision of two, as Carrie put, two classes, and the discomfort and the friction is indeed universal. And many, many people on one side or another of the economic divide certainly can relate to that. It's an added layer that, in fact, these two people come from the same background and that one of them managed to get out. But the actual collision certainly is universal and certainly would be recognizable to darn near anyone in this country, at least.
When she goes to their house, when Margie goes to her old boyfriend's house, and he's up in the world now, he lives in a better neighborhood, he's a doctor, he has this beautiful young wife, And she teaches literature for, I can't remember, Yale or Princeton or, and no, at a university, I can't remember something, but Margie says, what's the matter? Harvard wasn't good enough. Harvard wouldn't take you or something like that. And everybody laughs. But what the wife thinks is, oh, for a minute, my mother was here in the room. So everybody's been bashed some way. You guys remember that line? It's not a big deal, but it's like I think the playwright is trying to say that everybody has been from the wrong side of the tracks for a moment, at least, in some way. It's not just a dichotomy of rich and poor.
Well, I mean, everybody's felt like an outsider at some point or another, but... You know, I think that individual feeling is a little different from the group feeling of being from an outsider group, from a put down group. And I think that, you know, that the play really focuses on that, where, you know, I think most of the country, we don't think of Irish as a minority, but in this community, that immigrant root and that distinct culture is still part of that community. And this, you know, South Boston ethos is really strong, and it's very much a, you know, we are from the wrong side of the tracks, and there's also a pride in that, which is, you know, part of the conflict between Margie and her ex, is you know, you need to be true to your roots, and they're proud of those hardscrabble roots.
But you know, it's funny, you know, looking at it from the other end of the spectrum, my family. We're immigrants that came to the Lower East Side, and in fact, one of my great-great-grandfathers founded the first Yiddish language daily newspaper in this country. And when his children were able to graduate and basically went economically up a class, they were made themselves very distant from their roots. Just as Mike in this play doesn't want to be reminded where he came from, and while he will not, you know, overtly say he isn't from there, he doesn't like to be reminded where he comes from. And this is something that a lot of second-generation immigrants and third-generation immigrants find as they go, yes, I come from this background, but let's not talk about it. My mother tells a great story about how she was talking to her mother about growing up on the Lower East Side. Well, at some point or another, they moved to Riverside in Manhattan. And my grandmother apparently would go, we never lived on the Lower East Side. You know, and that's the same kind of thing that Mike, you know, is going through. Yes, I'm from Southie, but I'm a long ways from Southie, and I don't really want to have anything to do with it anymore.
And well, brags that he got out. He wants to brag. He wants to romanticize how horrible it was. And Margie calls him on that, too. She says, you know, struggle is part of life for all of us, you know, but we weren't miserable. It wasn't that bad. You didn't have it that bad. You had a father who came home, you know, who worked. You had a father. You had a father who worked. You had a father who checked your homework, you know. And Mike wants it to be as if it had been all bad, and he brought himself up out of it. You know, he worked himself out, and now he's a successful doctor, and it's all because of his hard work. And I mean,
I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, Mike, as a character, wants to have his cake and eat it too. And I think this, you know, having made it out of the hood, so to speak, the Irish hood, is part of his personal myth that he tells people, and is sort of his identity. And he sort of uses that toughness, that street cred, as a way of, you know, bolstering his personality quotient, if you will. And you know, so on the one hand, you start to think when Margie comes into his life that he's embarrassed by his past, but in a way, he also just doesn't want, you know, the more nuanced truth about his past to come forward into his new life and interrupt the mythic narrative that he has built out of it.
Yes.
You know what I wish is that all of us around the country could see filmed records of how different companies and different directors and different acting troupes treat the same material. I think Hope, your leading actress, came at this from a slightly different place. And again, my actress came at it a slightly different place than Frances McDormand. And I would love to figure out a way that we could all see what each other's people do with it. That's why when I travel, I'm part of the American Theater Critics Association, and we hold a conference in different cities. And I don't mind seeing a show I've seen before just to see what else somebody else brings to it.
I love that, actually. I love that. I go out of my way. Like, I would love to see. I mean, maybe that's a topic for another conversation, whether you can see a film of a stage production. Like, I'd rather just go in person. I'll sleep on your couch and see it, But I mean, I do like seeing different productions. And just the little conversation we've had here makes me think, yeah, maybe your guys's Margie was actually really different from the one here in Indianapolis, because she wasn't Carrie, what did you say, an elbow pusher? she's tough, but she's not, in fact, she's almost in tears at one point, because early on in the play, like the first scene, the man who's trying to fire her, and she says, I knew your mother. Remember when she tried to shoplift that turkey and she got caught, and it was so funny. And he finally says, yeah, I remember that. You called the police. And she comes back and says, no, I didn't call the police. Peg Moody, or whatever the other person's name, called the police. She called the police, and she got promoted to store manager, and I got fired eventually because I was late or something. I was too nice. So I think she's tough, but it wasn't as brassy, or it wasn't as feisty as what I'm hearing you guys say. So I would love to see all three productions, and the fourth, the one in New York, too.
Well, you can always go to the Lincoln Center library, where they have the most of the stuff on video, and see, you know, the original. Although, needless to say, there is virtually nothing that is on tape that is half as good as what you can see when you see it in the theater. But at least you get a sense of it.
Yeah.
I guess my final question is, I remember when it was the most produced play in 2012 to 2013, and most artistic directors were talking about, you know, the economic crisis, and that was a reason for putting it on because it seemed so prescient at the time. And now, three years later, save the union, we've added more jobs, we have Obamacare, everything's relatively a little bit better. So do you think it's still kind of as gut-wrenchingly relevant?
Oh, I think it's relevant. I think there's a paradigm, a word I despise, but there's a paradigm at work here where there are a lot of theaters like My Gable Stage, and obviously the ones that you two are serving. There is a shelf life for the hot new play coming off Broadway or off Broadway for a certain level of regional theater to do. And they all want to do it within the first year, two, or three of it getting a lot of buzz from the national press and even the local press. And after that two- or three-year period, I seem to see a slowing down for a lot of titles, and then it'll go two, three, four, 5 years, and then a much smaller, more modest company will pick it up. But there is a war down here, a very friendly war down here, to get certain pieces. I'm waiting for the war to break out over Disenchanted. Good Lord, what's the matter with me? The Ayad Akhtar play.
Disgraced,
what's the matter? I'm waiting to watch the fight occur down here for who's going to get Disgraced first. Now, it's going to be delayed since apparently it's going to start a national tour in November. But as soon as that becomes available, you watch, there will be, over a two- or three-year period, an intense number of productions. And then maybe two or three years later, then there may be another lull of another two or three years.
I definitely think it still feels relevant today. I mean, 2011 is not that long ago, and while the economy is doing better and Wall Street is doing better, I think people in the working class are not experiencing a great deal of economic relief right now. So I think that this play resonates certainly as much today as it did a couple of years ago. You know, whether it will have more longevity, I don't know. I try not to make predictions about that. I really like, if a play is going to be topical, to just be unapologetically topical, try to mean something today and, you know, let history take care of itself. So I don't know if this play will be produced a lot 10 years from now, but it's certainly a terrific play right now, and one I would hope people would go out to see if they had a chance.
And I would add, I love that you said that about if it's just be frankly topical and not worry about it. But I think this play has significance beyond its topical layer, because it's also about a more profound, who are we responsible for as human beings? There's a lot of talk in it about, but you know me, or I don't know you anymore because I haven't seen you for 30 years, or you know me, I knew your mother, and you know me, you don't know me. And there's a homeless woman that they just talk about that Margie and her friend went to school with, and now she's out living on the bridge, and then she's begging for money because her husband died and he left her nothing. And they refer to her more than once, this woman that they went to school with who's homeless. And then she dies, and Margie's talking about Cookie McDermott died. Did you hear about this? The whole time, they didn't do anything to help her. They knew her from school, and they didn't do a thing to help her. It's not a huge part of the play, and I didn't even notice it the first time I went to see it. But when I went to see it this past week, and I thought, that's what this play is about, is who are we responsible for? You know, if you see someone who needs help, you can't help everybody. You can't. So that's, I think we have a long way to go with that question as human beings, how to be compassionate and yet not destroy ourselves or something. You know what I mean? That line about who am I responsible for? Who can I help without and still take care of myself, because I'm responsible for myself too. I think there's all kinds of stuff that isn't topical. It's more eternal or something.
And can we just add that it's a really funny play?
Okay.
You know, dramedy is really the dominant form of plays right now. Things that have pack a dramatic wallet, but also have a lot of laughs. And this play has a lot of laughs, particularly with the character of Dottie, who is very well named, and her craft rabbits made out of flower pots. You know, it's clever, it's funny, and it sort of, you know, brings you into the serious side with the spoonful of sugar of a lot of very hilarious dialogue.
Yeah, I would agree.
Did anyone else want a craft rabbit after they saw this?
Well, can I just say one other thing? There's all those rabbits. Another thing that I didn't pick up on until the second time was that when Dottie tries to say to Stewie, when they're all at bingo, and she's selling her rabbits for $5 each, and she says, I'll give you 3 for $12. And he says, you know what? I just don't want any. They're not my taste. He's not being a selfish prick. He's not being nice. He's not letting her guilt trip him into buying the rabbits. He just doesn't want any. You know, everybody is not honest and direct for most of the play, but that moment was a really good moment. I don't know. Yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of humor in it, along with the wisdom.
I believe that's all of our time and a little bit more. Thank you. Thank you, all
three
of you. Yes, this was a really good conversation. I really enjoyed listening to it.
Welcome back. We'll close out with a couple of recommendations, things we saw, read, enjoyed, thought about that we'd like to share with you. Susie, you start off.
Well, I haven't been inundated with the January festival goings as my colleagues have. I have never really participated in it, but I hear it's a lot of fun. But
we're obviously cooler than you, Susie / probably crazier. Yeah,
yeah. I like to see January and February kind of as my theater going break. I take a little bit of a slow time these months just because I see a lot in March and April. But I did go to the theater this weekend, and I saw Hallie Pfeiffer's I'm Gonna Pray For You So Hard at Atlantic, which I spent some time at the O'Neill Theater Center this summer, and Hallie was one of the playwrights in residence, and I got to see a reading of the play, which was also and the reading at the O'Neill had the two actors and the same director that are doing it at the Atlantic, Reed Burney and Betty Gilpin, did the reading, and they're doing the production at Atlantic, and Trip Coleman was the director.
What's it about?
It is an interesting play. It's a little bit disturbing. I really enjoy plays about fathers and daughters. I feel like no woman can go see a play about fathers and daughters without thinking about her own father. This was not a play in which I wanted to be thinking about my own father. It is about a young actress who is waiting for the review of her latest show, and her father, who is a famous playwright, and he's basically, you know, lecturing her about how he became famous and became a playwright, and she's hanging on his every word because she idolizes him. They're on the New York Upper West Side apartment, and it basically turns into them getting wasted and smoking dope and crack and getting into some compromising positions. I will say there were some more compromising positions in the reading than there were in the production, which was comforting to see, but not so comforting because there was still a lot of the messed up shit. But it's a really good play. Hallie's language is very, very tight and very good. It's a two-hander, and it moves very quickly. You're definitely intrigued. Reed Burney gives a great performance. He has to memorize basically the whole play because he talks the most in the first scene. There's two scenes, and the first scene is a lot longer. I won't spoil the second scene for you. And he's basically talking a lot, and it's... Yeah, it's interesting, and I think one of the things that makes it most interesting that hasn't really been talked about in a lot of coverage of the show, and I don't know if it's entirely relevant, is that it feels like it could be somewhat autobiographical on Hallie's part.
What?
She has not completely, and she did talk with the New York Times about how it's definitely a very over-dramatization of something.
But her father is Jules Pfeiffer.
But her father is Jules Pfeiffer, who is a famous playwright, and the play is about a famous playwright and his daughter, who's a young actress who he tells to become a playwright, and Hallie is a young actress who then became a playwright, and she grew up on the Upper West Side, I believe, and
it's set on
the Upper West Side. So, I mean, I'm all about using your own experiences to make your art, and I know a lot of writers do, and so more power to Hallie. I don't know how much...
We just want to know if she smoked crack with her dad.
Basically...
And gone to compromising positions with her dad.
Basically, if you just... It's an interesting thing to ponder as you're watching the show. It does not affect your enjoyment of the show. It's definitely a very well-written play.
Right.
Very well-acted. Very well-directed. Hallie is obviously a very talented playwright. And I definitely recommend seeing it. It's just it's an interesting question about art. How much should a playwright's own life affect how we view their art if we know about their life?
What I'm curious about is it's a two-hander about father daughter, and there's a little bit of controversy. So do you think it's one of these things that might get produced a lot?
I don't know if there's been that much controversy about it.
Like, I mean,
I don't think there's I mean, I think it's a great play. I do. I want to say that on the record. Like, it is a great play, and these are great performances.
There aren't that many plays about father daughters, are there?
Well, Fun Home.
I mean,
right, but that's an exception. Right? There's a lot of
I guess not controversy,
plays,
but it's kind of titillating.
A lot of mother-son plays.
I think it's
plays.
An easy play to produce. It's two actors. I mean, you have to find an older male actor who can memorize
a lot of lines. Good luck.
And I think, I mean, it's definitely risque. It's not like PG, so theaters have to be willing to like have crack and
everyone
stuff
who produced,
on their stage.
Yeah. Everyone who produced Venus and Fur.
Well, yeah, it kind of has a feel of that. I think it's an easy play to produce. It's one set. If you have two gangbusters act, I think it would get produced a lot. It is a good play.
So I'm going to just quickly recommend Hamilton. I saw an early preview of Lin-Manuel Miranda's new show, which is mostly hip-hop and some R&B and pop and musical theater at the Public Theater. Almost entirely a song and rap through piece. about the founding fathers, mainly Alexander Hamilton, but also George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. It doesn't sound like it should work, but it works even better than you can imagine. I think it's I'm going to say right now, I think it's one of my favorite musicals ever.
Boom.
I think it's going to be in the canon. So that's just, I don't want to say much more. I
well,
would just
Lynn
say
has
that
been working on it for a long time.
He's been working on it, but you know, most of the work has been in the past couple of years. He sort of started it. I will just say this. I liked In the Heights fine, and it had some good hip-hop, good rap in it. But basically, this one started as a mixtape, as a trying to rap like he likes, like his favorite rappers, Big Pun and Jay-Z, and put as much content and as dense, you know, and as edgily produced as they do, and he just decided to do that, and his faith in that form has totally paid off theatrically. It's I'm not even a big hip hop fan, but this musical makes me want to become a hip hop fan and read more about history. So
the whole run is sold out, so have fun getting tickets.
I think we can say, yeah, we shouldn't predict its future, but I don't think it's going away, is what I'll say that. Yeah.
Well, there's been hubbub around it forever. I mean, it was at New York Stage and Film last summer.
Yes, it was. And it had a workshop in May.
Lynn did some work on it. I don't know if he did some work on it, but he was part of the Johnny Mercer songwriting project at Northwestern while I was there. And he performed some songs from it back in 2009, so he's been definitely percolating for a long time.
Well, the famous thing in 2009 is that the White House was doing an evening of poetry and spoken word, and they asked him, they said, do you have anything about the American experience? And they said, you could do something in the Heights. He goes, well, I have a 16 bars about Alexander Hamilton, a mixtape I'm doing. He did that. That was recorded. You see the Obamas giving a standing ovation. That kind of created a momentum around this idea that, you know, might have happened anyway, but really, like, everyone saw that video. It's like, what's this Hamilton thing? You got to do this.
President Obama wants a new musical. Wonder if they're going to come see it.
I don't know if they get in the public, but it might go elsewhere. So
you don't think the president and the first lady would get into the public?
Sure, they probably could.
I'm sure they could get into the run of the public if they wanted to.
I think they can get into
the last
most
time the president
things.
Came to see a show that I know of was Joe Turner, and it was on Broadway, and the show was held by 40 minutes just to get them in there with the security.
Raisin in the Sun. They saw Raisin in the Sun.
Okay. Was that held for 40 minutes?
I don't know, but I definitely was held getting to happy hour because the motorcade was coming through.
I think the public is a smaller theater. Anyway, I don't know. I think they should see it.
They have security. They have people?
Yeah, I know they got their people.
The Secret Service can get in, too.
It's funny, they'll have to walk through a statue of... they borrowed the statues from the New York Historical Society of Burr and Hamilton shooting guns at each other. And you walk through the theater between these two statues of them. So somehow security will probably be nervous about that. But recommendations, Deep? Or recommendation?
Recommendation. I guess recommendations, because it's technically performed in pieces. For my yearly festival binge... This year I saw Taylor Mack's a 24-decade history of popular music, 1900s to 1920s, and I loved it so much, I came back the next week and saw the 1930s to 1950s. 24-decade.
24-decade?
He's going to continue developing it in pieces.
So it starts in the 1700s?
It's going to go from 1776 to 2016 when he finally finishes. And it's going to culminate in a 24-hour performance.
So it is 24-hour. 24-hour, 24-decade.
Yeah, it will be 24 hours. And there's going to be 24 musicians around him. And every hour they will lose a musician. And okay. At the end it'll just be him. And there will be like 24, you know, chorus girls or Tiny Tims. I can't quite remember what he said. And by the end they'll just... kill them off or something like that.
And so when he gets to the present day, it'll just be him?
Yeah.
Singing Taylor Swift or something?
Whatever that's going to be in 2016.
The score of Hamilton. No,
the score.
I didn't know if that's popular music.
It should be.
Well, maybe it will be. Rent got into the popular canon.
But basically Taylor's show is like kind of a part cabaret, part musical history lesson, and there's also audience participation, which if you know me, you know I love me some audience participation. I like
I didn't
doing
know
things.
That.
Yeah.
You love that?
I love being made to do things.
That's I hate audience participation.
That's so refreshing because I think that there's such a glut of these shows lately that where everyone has to start off going, well, you know me, I hate audience participation, but this show, but you just love it from the start. That's
exactly.
Great.
Exactly. It's like, if you don't like it, you don't like fun.
Well, I look forward to that Taylor Mack thing. It sounds great.
Is it still running? No, but he's going to continue developing it, and he's been touring it all over the country, and I've only seen him in Good Person, but I feel like in this, he's at the top of his form, because it's funny. It's like, I was thinking about the show, and it made me realize the thing, it solidified what it is I like about theater when I love it. Like, the plays, the things that I see that I love usually are, they're funny, and they have, like, something, like, really biting to say about the world we live in, about race, about gender, or just about, like, society in general, mm-hmm. which is why I love things like Octoroon and Booty Candy.
Booty Candy, yeah.
And they also vaguely make you feel really uncomfortable.
Okay.
And it's like, I like feeling uncomfortable.
I have a confession. I've never seen Taylor Mack do anything. The only time I've seen him is when he was the AT 25th anniversary party. He did like a little speech thing. And that's the only time I've ever seen him do his thing. I've met him and talked to him. He's a lovely guy.
Oh,
and I'm
gosh.
Like, well, I never.
And if you go to 1930s and 1950s, you will see Taylor Mack do the soliloquy from Carousel.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That'd be worth it. I
in full drag regalia with
the next
sparkles.
Thing to look forward to, he's doing a show with Mandy Patinkin.
Yes, The Last Two People on Earth. Mandy said,
when are they doing
me.
That?
At American Repertory Theater, right?
Yeah.
When?
Yeah.
In May or something? Or?
Well, road trip.
Yeah.
It was at Classic Stage, and I couldn't get into that.
Oh, yeah, it was
at
Classic Stage. See, I can't
right?
get into yeah. these things.
And they didn't let any press into that show, actually.
Well, his play's coming to Playwrights Horizons.
Yeah, here, HIR.
I would love to see, when we published, I would love to see him and Mandy do a Carousel, a soliloquy off, because like that's a song that Mandy was born to do.
I know. Because when Taylor was talking about, when he was setting up the song, he said something to the effect of, I will probably never get cast in this role,
yeah,
but I'm
sure.
going to do it anyway.
Well, the funny thing is, when we published Taylor's play here, and Lisa Crone did the play script interview, and one thing that she said that got cut for print was she said, I would love to see Taylor do Sondheim, because I think he would be great in a Sondheim show. And I think he would, too.
Yes.
But he never gets cast in those. They see him as this performance art. But he could do great Sondheim.
Well, I mean, you know, he would be a great Hedwig.
He would be a great Hedwig.
I think I suggested that to him on Twitter, and he said, I'm not a big enough star for that production. You know, it's...
I think
he would love to have done it, like, you know, 12, 15 years ago when it was first here.
Yeah, well, why not do Hedwig regionally or something? They do Hedwig regionally.
I mean, I think his point is he wants to create his own work now.
Yeah.
He would be great in musical theater, but I don't think he's ever done it.
But he talked about, when we had a play script interview, something like Sondheim was interesting to him. I think he could be great.
Well, he's doing
a great Sweeney Todd.
Oh, jeez. I would watch the hell out of that.
I think you need to be a baritone, don't you?
Whatever. It's Taylor Mack.
Okay, all right.
They can falsetto that role up for him. It's fine.
He could almost play Bobby in a Great Version of Company. That would
be
awesome.
That would be great.
Although he doesn't get to sing much as Bobby, so. Anyway, yeah. We could talk all day. Let's dream casting for Taylor Mack Sondheim. Write into us.
Yeah, write into us. Which Sondheim show do you want to see Taylor Mack in?
at tcg.org.
Or tweet us at American Theater.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Write to your local artistic directors and tell them to cast Taylor Mack in Carousel. That was an almost perfect soliloquy.
Thanks for listening to another week of Off Script. We went very off script. It was great.
Yes.
Take care.